You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to episode 27 of Ethnosinology. I'm your host, David Ian Howe. I'm an anthropologist and archaeologist, and I'm here with Mesoamericanist, or how would you describe yourself?
So I'm probably a Mayanist, but we're going to talk a little bit about Mesoamerica in general. Yeah, and my name is Zach Lindsay, and I do focus on the Maya, but we'll talk a little bit about what Mesoamerica is, how it's a pretty big culture region, and of course, we're going to talk a little bit about some cute puppies as well.
Absolutely, man. So yeah, so could you, just for the audience listening, could you tell me a little bit about yourself, how you got into archaeology, and like where you're at now?
Sure. I started off as a journalist, and I was working in Mexico City in about 2010, 2011 for an American newspaper. And so I was doing correspondence for them. And I started to visit museums in Mexico City. And if you've ever been to Mexico City, you know that Mexico City is absolutely stuffed with museums. So yeah. This is back again, 2011, 2010-ish. And I had a blog where every weekend I was going to a different museum and writing up a little description of the museum. And once I got back to the States after that time was done, people would say, oh, did you go to this museum? Did you go to this museum? And I'd never even heard of it, you know, because that's how many museums there are in that city that it's possible to go to one pretty much every weekend. So that started to get me more into the history of Mexico. And I started to really focus on the people that we today call the Aztecs and also the site of Teotihuacan, which is in central Mexico. These are both amazing, massive sites. Teotihuacan is really mind-blowing to visit, really giant structures. And we have found evidence that they did interact with dogs at that particular site. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But we have found dogs in burials at Teotihuacan. So we know that they were important in a variety of different ways. But we'll come back to puppies, of course. So I started to fall in love with archaeology and with Teotihuacan. I had focused previously on journalism, and so I decided to go back to school for archaeology and learn more about what archaeology is and how to pursue it. And I kind of had some bad timing.
Sure.
So I got my master's degree in 2020, so I kind of got out of school with nobody really wanted to be digging with a bunch of strangers. So yeah, it was kind of a rough time for when I got out. And so I've been sort of doing peripheral things to archaeology, like tourism and taking people out to archaeological sites. So I mentioned before that I studied Teotihuacan, and we're going to talk a little bit about what Mesoamerica is so that folks have a better understanding of that. But Teotihuacan, again, is a city in central Mexico, and y'all might have heard of the Maya. They're obviously a very well-known culture. Movie The Apocalypto, right, was sort of this famous movie. They had their 2012 moments of fame. And so that culture is pretty well known, and I always knew that they were very advanced, and I started to learn that they had a very intricate system of writing. And as somebody who grew up very interested in poetry and writing, I started to become really interested in their writing system. And I remember when I was first studying them, I actually cut myself off and I said, I don't want to keep studying the Maya, because then I'm going to stop studying Teotihuacan, and I really want to study Teotihuacan. But I already knew that I was sort of being drawn towards the Maya, especially because of their written language. And so here I am in Yucatan today, which is, you know, contemporary Maya people make up a huge percentage of the population. The local Mayan language, which is called Mayatan, is still spoken by something like 1.5 million people or something like that.
That's incredible.
And so I'm deeply in the Maya area. Honestly, haven't studied Teotihuacan too much, except through the lens of how they interacted with the Maya lately. So that younger mentality of don't study the Maya because you're going to forget about Teotihuacan was totally correct. And I kind of have really moved my focus over to this specific area. And yeah, I love it. I wouldn't go back. I'm part of the Institute of Maya Studies. I'm on their board. We're one of the longest running academic institutes that work with the Maya. And, you know, it's a pleasure to be a part of that organization, and it's a pleasure to do work for them. And so, you know, again, although the Maya are a specific region of Mesoamerica, I kind of have cut myself off a little bit from some of the other areas of Mesoamerica to really focus in on the Maya.
Sure. A couple questions there, but mainly my first question, Teotihuacan is that's like the temple complex that's outside of Mexico City, correct?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like the big temple. And again, absolutely huge site. Geometrically, it's very linear and delineated. The plumbing still works there. So when it rains, right, the pipes still take water away from the city. So again, engineering feats that are really incredible at the site. And of course, there's the two big pyramids, the Pyramid of the Sun and the Pyramid of the Moon, not their ancient names, but what we call them today. And there have been burials found at those sites. And again, we'll kind of come back to why they might have had dogs in the burials with them, but there were dog bones or wolf bones found in the burials with them.
Sure. My next question for you too then was, I have another question about Aztecs, Mexico stuff, but journalism, what got you, like you started as a journalist and then you kind of shifted to anthropology. What did that for you?
Yeah, well, so I've made the joke before and I'll probably make it again that I'm probably the only person I get into archaeology for the money, because journalism in the mid 2000s, right, 2010, 2011, was going through a huge growing pains phase with the introduction of more online news and a lot of newspapers that had previously existed without problem for many decades were suddenly really not able to make that transition to online. And so I was kind of bouncing from job to job and it didn't seem like anything was really sticking. And at the same time, my writing was starting to focus more on culture and the past and history anyway. And so again, I saw Teotihuacan on a visit. I went out to visit the site as part of like a tourism group, nothing super, it wasn't like I was digging or anything like that, or, you know, investigating through the jungle. I was with a big group of people, but I saw it. It really blew my mind and it changed how I wanted to approach what I was writing about. And so, you know, I still consider myself a communicator, even if I'm not really actively doing journalism. I mentioned the Institute of Maya Studies. One of the things that I do with the Institute of Maya Studies is I write a monthly column for their magazine, The Explorer. And in that column, I talk about events from ancient Maya history. I do my best to try to not make it, you know, extremely boring for somebody who doesn't maybe know that much about the Maya. So I think my goal of kind of connecting people with science ideas is still part of what I do.
Sure. No, that's awesome, man. Definitely one of the few people I've heard get into it for the money. So that's a good joke. Keep that going. My next question, and we can talk more about, like, you know, Mesoamerican history in general, but I use this interchangeably all the time and I get corrected a lot, but then I get corrected by other camps of people that say that's fine. Aztec versus Mexica. And to my understanding, the Aztecs were comprised of three tribes. One of them was the Mexica. So what is like the proper term to use when we're referring to the Aztecs?
Yeah, so that is a great point, right? It gets very confusing as to which is correct. And it does kind of seem like no matter what you say, somebody's going to be unhappy.
I've noticed that.
So really, when we talk about that area, we're talking about speakers of the Nahuatl language, right? And so today we call those people Nahua. And so that is actually, I think that's an okay term, because it kind of gets rid of the political structures around it. When we're talking about Cortez arriving and going into the city of Tenochtitlan and, you know, Tlatelolco and conquering those two cities, there we're definitely talking about the Mexica, because we're talking about, because those were the Mexica, right? Now, the Aztec Triple Alliance, that was a group of political entities that were working together, and they had kind of their outsiders, they had their insiders. Pretty complicated political situation. That's why sometimes when we're talking about beliefs, these beliefs kind of spread out across what we today call the Aztec Empire. I personally think when we're talking about this, the territory that they covered, it's okay to talk about the Aztec Empire, because we are talking about this entity that was formed from the Triple Alliance, right? Sure. But again, it is a complicated and like loaded term. And my personal thought is, especially on something like a podcast, I tend to just use the term Aztec because it's what people know and are familiar with.
It's like an exonym that I'm familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think that's a good, as long as you're looking at it like an exonym, it's the simplest way of talking about the people, I think.
Sure. Okay. I never really thought about Nahua being, you know, a good catch-all for all that too. That's a good point. So yeah, you're with the Center of Mayan Studies. If you don't mind, before we get into dogs, can you, and I mean, you're a journalist, you're obviously a great communicator. Can you just gush about, you know, the history of the Maya and the, you know, the Mexican, the Aztecs, the Nahuas, whoever, you know, your understanding of that part of the world?
Yeah. So one thing I mentioned before that I really love the fact that Maya has, you know, the classic Mayan writing is a full language, right? So we have in the Aztec pictograms, we do have examples of words written out, but they're usually just nouns. We don't have examples of full sentences written out. But with the Maya, we have full sentences written out. And to me, that is just so cool because you're really getting a look at what they were saying and what they were thinking. And they are, I always say they put Hemingway to shame with how terse and brief they are sometimes. So they, you know, there's a famous inscription that I like to talk about where they say something like, I forget the exact wording, but they're basically like, on this date, the youth descended. And that's the sentence. Descended what? You know, to the ancient Maya, it was obvious what they descended. To us, there's a debate about exactly what was going on when they were descending. You know, different, a couple of different logical possibilities. But my point isn't really what it actually means. My point is more the idea that we do run into these situations a lot where their writing is so concise that we struggle to unpack the meaning of it. And that's kind of one of the things that actually makes it interesting to me is that there is a lot of depth in just very short sentences and kind of trying to figure out comparing the sentences to what's going on in the art and the iconography sometimes helps us to flesh out what is going on and gives us a little bit better of an idea. And we can use them to learn a lot about history. So some folks who, you know, maybe aren't keeping up with what's going on in decipherment of Maya hieroglyphs might have heard, you know, that everything on these inscriptions is just dates. It's all calendric information. And there is a heck of a lot of calendric information. There's a heck of a lot of information about dates on their inscriptions. But they're really using that to tell history. So it's sort of like they're writing out the long form. It's almost like instead of saying, you know, I don't know, on October 23rd, they might say on Thursday, October 23rd, you know, 2025, which is this moon sign and which is this many days after the birth of Christ exactly. And, you know, this sort of long form information and then ending it with this was the day that the king entered into office. And because we have that information, we really have a look at Maya history that we don't get in a lot of other pre-Hispanic American places, because we do have, we have the names of their kings, we have how long they ruled for, we have who they were married to, we have their enemies, their friends, we have what they did at certain points in their lives. So we're able to construct true biographies of their kings and queens and really get an idea about them that is a lot more complex, about the people, about the individuals who were part of the Maya Empire. There's a lot more, pardon me, about Maya culture.
Sure.
That was, I'll say why I wanted to correct that in a moment. But we get a very deep idea about who they were and what their goals were. And sometimes we get funny stuff about them too. There's an inscription that talks about a pet parrot. There's another inscription that I might mention a little bit later if we have time, about a pet dog. So the inscription is on the back of a dog sculpture, and it's telling you that this is the dog of a famous chocolatier. And so we get those kind of little windows into people's lives. And then there are even a few places where we get some dirty jokes, which is absolutely awesome to get to see a dirty joke that is, you know, from the 700s or the 600s. So I accidentally said the Maya Empire, and I wanted to correct myself because it's something that I see in the news a lot. I like hate myself for doing it, but I actually think it's nice, like nice detail. There was no Maya Empire, right? There was no center. There was no core to the Maya. When we talk about the Maya, we're actually talking about a few, well, multiple, something kind of like city-states, a little bit more, somewhere sort of between what we think of when we think of Athens and Troy, and maybe contemporary state. So that's sort of how they were organized. And there were, at different points in Maya history, there were different cities that were very prominent and almost got to the point of taking over all their neighbors, but there was always something that held them back. So one of the big things was there's a site called Tikal. Tikal is a famous site in Guatemala. It was actually used in the first Star Wars movie. So there's a scene where they come down to the planet, or the Yavin 4, which is the moon, and there's some guy looking through some goggles as the Millennium Falcon flies by, and there's a jungle and pyramids, and that's Tikal. So still important in pop culture, still kind of wowing people today, I think.
Yeah.
And it was, in ancient times, a very important Maya city. And for a while, it was thought to be the most important. It was thought to be the capital of the Maya Empire. But we now know that it never managed to rise to that level. And there was another city called Calakmul, which is in Mexico, and less known, but still a very beautiful site. And they had, their dynasty is called the Snake Dynasty. So sometimes people have heard a little bit about the Snake Dynasty as this very major important player in Maya politics. If you're reading the news every once in a while, there will be some story that says something about, you know, a new discovery about the Snake Dynasty. And that's what they're talking about, the people of Calakmul. And Tikal and Calakmul were at it for pretty much the entire time that both cities existed. And that Cold War may have been one of the things that led to the sort of collapse of the various Maya polities in the classic era. Again, you might hear it referred to as the collapse of Maya civilization or the end of Maya civilization. And in fact, that wasn't really the case, right? Some of the most important, most famous today, Maya cities like Tulum, cities like Chichen Itza, those cities actually came up after the classic era collapse. So again, Maya culture continued just in a very different form. And that's some stuff that I really like about studying the history, is you can actually get a window into those specific rulers' lives. And you can start to see some of the things that the factors that might have led to the collapse just based on what people are talking about in their inscriptions. So yeah, that's one thing that I think is just really cool. And also, again, we can really get this deep window into I've been mentioning individuals, kings, queens. You can kind of start to see who was a jerk, who was not a jerk, right? Mm-hmm. We have this image of Bielas Negras Stela 3, which has a little girl on it. And it kind of endears us to the little girl in a way that a lot of the more severe Maya art just doesn't. And that aspect also, I think, really makes them very human. So that's really what excites me about them, getting to know these individuals and getting to know the things that they liked and cared about and felt the need to protect. And one of the things that we think that they felt the need to protect based on some of their inscriptions were their dogs, right?
Yeah. One sidebar question to that too is, why do you think they were so detailed with all of their, like, to the date, the time, the moon, like all that? Like, what drove that?
Yeah, so I haven't really talked too much about what Mesoamerica is, but if for folks who aren't super familiar with it, Mesoamerica is, we typically say it's an area that goes up to about the Sonora Desert, so it's a little bit south of the Mexican-U.S. border. So it stops before the desert. We call the desert arid America usually, and then, you know, the folks who refer to Mesoamerica refer to the desert as arid America. I know there's a couple different terms among archaeologists. And then it goes down about as far as El Salvador and Honduras, right? And so it's most of Mexico and about half of Central America is what we consider to be Mesoamerica. And Mesoamerica was connected by belief systems. So there are certain things, certain traits that existed in Mesoamerican culture that either didn't really exist in other indigenous American cultures or weren't quite as important in other indigenous American cultures. And so that's how we kind of divide Mesoamerica. One of the things, and one of the chief things that we use to define Mesoamerica, is the idea of the sacred calendar. And the sacred calendar is a 260-day calendar that different people will tell you different things. I've read a couple great studies, and I've actually talked to local indigenous Maya people who agree with these studies, so I tend to lean towards this. The idea was that it was originally used to count the average gestation of a human infant. So the calendar was used to make sure that pregnancies were coming along in a healthy way. And that calendar also was tied to a solar calendar, which had the agricultural cycles built in. So when you put these two calendars together, you have this calendar that explains agricultural cycles, and then you have another calendar that explains human gestation. And together they are not just measuring cycles, they're essentially being used to talk about philosophical beliefs. So you might hear about Maya astronomy, and usually what people are talking about when they talk about Maya astronomy isn't actually astronomy. What they're talking about is when someone was born in the sacred calendar. It doesn't have to do with the planets. It has to do with the gestational periods. Mm-hmm. And so this idea of your date of birth affecting your personality was pretty philosophical, and it had a lot to do with the philosophy of the area. And so kind of picking it apart and finding new ways to explain it and finding new ways to divide it was really had importance in Mesoamerican philosophy. And so time in general kind of had that value. A couple other reasons. The rulers also wanted to kind of show these sacred connections to the very ancient past, right? The Maya calendar is cyclical, so it doesn't have a start point, doesn't have an end point. When people said, oh, 2012, Maya calendar ends, that not correct, right? The Maya calendar didn't end in 2012. It was just a cycle that ended, and we moved on to a new cycle. And when we go back far enough, we can also see that the Maya calendar can actually be used to count, if we wanted to, we could count billions of years back in time with it. And the Maya calendar that we understand typically started on the date 3114 BCE. So a good long time before a lot of the stuff we're talking about on the show. The Maya were the classic era of, or the most famous era of the Maya was about from like 200 AD to about 900 AD. So we're talking about events that happened in the very far past, and yet the Maya were able to record these events. They were able to put meaning on these events. And, you know, interestingly enough, turns out that a lot of times the rulers somehow just happened to have a great-great-great-great-grandfather who was at the creation of the Earth, right? And so sure. That was sort of their claim to the throne. So
yes.
Kind of a complex answer, but it is something that was really complex for the people of Mesoamerica as well. And, you know, that belief did exist in other areas. The Aztecs had a version of the sacred calendar. The Maya had a version of the sacred calendar. We're going to talk a little bit more about Colima, which is on the West Coast. They also had a version of the sacred calendar. But the Maya were the folks who really just made it very detailed.
Yeah, absolutely. With that, we're going to take a quick commercial break, but we'll be right back. And we're back with Zach Lindsay. We're talking about Mesoamerica and dogs. And yeah, do you want to just tell me more about like what you've understood from there? And you'd mentioned earlier that they clearly had care in their inscriptions for dogs as well as their children. So yeah, could you just talk to me about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So just to give a little bit of some background on dogs in the Americas in general.
Yeah.
First thing that I wanted to say is archaeologists, right? We tend to be a little bit of jacks of all trades, but then we have a very narrow focus. And my focus is on art history. I'm going to talk a little bit about genetics, which I know some things about, but I'm not an expert on it. So, you know, I'm going to try really hard to make sure that I get it right. But just so y'all know, if I say some fact that blows your mind, you might want to just make sure that I'm not talking out my rear. But so when we talk about dogs in the Americas, recent studies have shown that dogs came from the old world with the first people to come to the Americas. So we don't think that American wolves were domesticated. We think that the animals that early Americans brought with them from Asia, those were the same dogs that were, you know, the breeds that existed in the Americas were descended from those. There was no domestication of American wolves. And so that also meant that there was a little bit of room for some bottlenecking and things like that. Species having interesting genetic mutations that were emphasized over years of breeding. And so in Mesoamerica, specifically, there were at least two types of dogs. And a little bit of some mysteries about what happens to them, how things unfolded. But the two types of dogs that at least that we know of are Tlaochichi. And that's a smaller dog, and that dog, it's, you know, maybe two feet tall, according to some of the Spanish documents that we have. But eventually those dogs may have been bred into Chihuahuas. So contemporary Chihuahuas might have come from this Tlaochichi dog and a combination of European dogs.
Interesting.
Then there's another type of dog which was very popular during, especially for the Aztecs, and that dog was called the Xolo Isquintli. And I'll talk a little bit about what that means. Most people today just call them Xolos because it's a little easier than saying Xolo Isquintli every time, right? But those dogs have some interesting genetic mutations. I have a friend who has one. Very cute dogs, also kind of weird. So they don't have much hair. They're almost entirely hairless. They're usually kind of wrinkly. They have this dark black skin. And then sometimes they'll have sort of a little mohawk going on here and a little poof of hair on their tail. But that's pretty much it. Today, the breed has some issues. And we do think those issues might have existed in ancient times as well. But they have some issues, like they tend to have high body temperatures. So they have a lot of belly sweat. They have breeding issues too, and that's something that is pretty important. We do think they had breeding issues in ancient times as well, which is one of the reasons that the breed started to die off once the Spaniards arrived, because there was no one intentionally breeding them anymore.
Sure.
So the term Xolo Isquintli actually means, Xolo actually means deformed or monstrous or weird, and Isquintli is dog, so their name literally means... My wife was very sad to hear this, but their name literally means like deformed dog or weird looking dog. And so maybe not the nicest term for them, but it is true that they have what I would call a creepy cute vibe, right?
Yeah. Sure.
It has to be a special type of person who likes them, I think. But they were used for hunting. They were also used for food. So there's some crossover here. And I know a lot of times Westerners get, like, it's hard to get that in your mind, right?
Sure.
That dogs could be... One dog might be a pet and another dog might end up on your table, and how to kind of reconcile that situation. The way that I tend to think of it is my grandmother used to live on a farm and she had her pet chicken, and they also had chickens that they would kill and eat, right?
Right.
So when she was a toddler, there was this chicken that would come into bed with her. And when she was very young, she had this, it was her chicken, you know, and that was the pet chicken. And then there were also chickens that, you know, we're going to end up on your plate. And as a young person, she didn't really have, there wasn't any discord between that activity. And she was allowed to keep her chicken. And I kind of feel like if most parents would have realized that if they would have killed that chicken, they would have had a meltdown on their hands that they probably would avoid, right? So I think something kind of similar is going on there where, you know, it is a little weird to say, but you can have a dog that you use for hunting and that is your family pet. And then another dog that you don't know that is being, that you buy at the market as food, right?
Right. And to my understanding too, in most indigenous American cultures, that's pretty prevalent too. And Cook noted that in Polynesia as well. It's like there's a food items and then there's just pet dog. It's just something weird. Westerners don't have, I guess, but yeah.
Right. Anyway. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, actually, when I was living in Laredo, I had a friend who had a pet rooster. So it still occasionally happens, right? And we know that dogs were getting treated pretty well because we do find evidence that they were eating pretty much the same foods as people. So there was a lot of table scraps being fed to them. And again, their diets were consistent with the idea that they were certainly not being starved. They got a lot of attention. And they got a lot of attention in art as well. And so they were really important in art. And we think that one of the reasons that they were so important in art was because they were not just companions in this life, but companions in the next life as well. Right. This is one of the things that I think is really interesting about the portrayals of dogs in art, because we do see them as psychopomps, right? The entities that help lead people through the underworld.
Yeah.
And we'll kind of talk about that in a little bit, but I also kind of wanted to mention that Mesoamericans did not have a lot of domestic animals. So the only domestic animals they really had were dogs and turkeys. Mm-hmm. And there's some debate about whether you can consider bees domesticated or not, but basically the only real animals that they had as domesticated were dogs and turkeys, right? And this goes back a long time too. So I was talking before about the 700s AD or CE, if you prefer, and this goes back to about 1500 BCE, which is when we find the first dog skeletons at the site of Tlaxcala, which is a small site in central Mexico that is very old. And there's some debate about whether Tlatilco was one of the influences on the Olmec culture or whether the Olmecs were influencing Tlatilco. There's clearly some kind of back and forth going on. A lot of times people say the Olmecs were the first culture in this area. And that might very well be true, but it's also possible that these folks from Tlatilco were kind of doing some of these big ideas were coming out of that area as well. So we know that dogs have been a part of the Mesoamerican story pretty much forever, as long as there was a Mesoamerica. And when the Spaniards arrived, obviously things changed a lot in this area. Mm-hmm. One of the things that the Spaniards did was they wanted to bring in European plants, they wanted to bring European animals, they wanted to make sure that the things that were being grown here were European crops, so it was easier for them to export that. And along with that, they did bring dogs, and the dogs interbred with local dogs, and eventually it was believed that specifically that Xolo Iscuintli, that they were gone completely, that they did not exist anymore, that the breed had gone completely extinct. Then in the 1940s, so, you know, you're talking the 1500s to the 1940s, we essentially thought this dog breed was extinct. Certain dog shows in Mexico City, people started showing up with these dogs out of nowhere. No one had even recognized them as a breed at this point, and all of a sudden they were showing up in these dog shows. So the Mexican government got together with, I think the British government, I could be wrong about that, but they got together with the foreign government, and they started going out to the most remote rural regions that they could and searching for these dogs. And they found enough that by the 1950s, they were able to say that this is actually a specific breed of dog. It's not just, you know, a one-shot genetic abnormality. And so once that happened in the 1950s, the dogs were recognized as this specific breed. Their connection to pre-Hispanic America was noted. And it started to become cool among Mexicans to have this dog because it was a sign of cultural pride, right? And yeah. So nowadays there's actually a good amount of them. I know someone who has a rescue center specifically for them. And so they've sort of taken on a second life as a cultural symbol. That said, the Xolo Iscuintli that exists today has a lot of European influence in it. So, you know, it's not exactly the same dog. So, yeah, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about art and how these dogs appear in art. Again, my focus is art history, and specifically I focus on something that some folks find a little bit strange. I focus on what is known as the aesthetic of the cute. And so we think a lot about sublime art, and, you know, a famous example of sublime art in the Western canon is The Scream, right? So when we look at that painting, we feel his anxiety, right? He created that painting in a moment, or he was inspired to create that painting during an anxiety attack. And so the painting itself has an anxiety to it. And that's the emotion that we feel when we see it. And that's an example of the sublime. You know, another example of the sublime might be that famous picture of that Goya did of Saturn eating his own son, Saturn devouring his own son. Very, a little disturbing to see, right? And so a lot of times when we think of art, we think that it needs to invoke very powerful emotions, and those emotions need to be, I guess, you know, like bad ones or strongly emotions that deeply affect us in a way that is profound. There are other styles of art, though, right? Not everything has to have that effect on people. And today, a number of scholars, Joshua Dale is one of them, for example, he specifically studies art history in Japan, where kawaii objects or cute objects are part of the artistic canon and have been for not just the last 100 years, but really for 500, 600 years, we see examples of cute art appearing in the Japanese canon. And so cute art isn't something new, and it is art. And sometimes there's a little bit of pushback when I say that. So, you know, if we think of something like Hello Kitty, she does inspire emotions, whether we want to think of her that way or not, right? And she often does inspire a loving sense of care, a sense of desire to care for an object. And also, you know, when we see another person who has the same cute that we have, there tends to be an immediate social connection, right? So if you've ever seen, you know, especially little kids, my daughter, if she sees a backpack that has Kuromi, who's one of Hello Kitty's friends, you know, if she sees a backpack that has that character on it, across the room, across the park, she's going to scream and say, "Oh my God, it's so amazing, it's Kuromi," right? And then she's going to want to immediately be friends with that person. And so if we think of art as something that inspires emotion, that right there is an emotion, right? So So cute art really does have that effect. And the effect that it tends to have is community building. So I've actually found a lot of examples of art that meet the definition of cute in ancient Mesoamerica. And even though we think of Mesoamerican art as very scary, if you're familiar with Mesoamerican art, you might have seen the lintels from Yaxchilan that show a woman bringing a rope through her tongue. So
yeah, I've seen that.
Certainly not cute.
Right.
But yeah, there is cute Mesoamerican art too. And one of the most common cute pieces are dogs, right? And now another thing that people say a lot of times when I say, oh, this art is cute, they say, well, how can you say that it's really cute? And there are ways, just like we can look at an image that is sublime and say that, well, there are certain factors that give it that, you know, condition. There are certain things that we see in cute art that is regular and consistent among cute pieces across the world. And so when we look at these, especially dogs from a place called Colima, which is Western Mesoamerica, I haven't really talked too much about Colima, but this is where we see the Colima dogs. And these dogs are very famous tourist items. A lot of places, tchotchke shops, will have replicas of Colima dogs. And they're these sort of cute puppies that are oftentimes chewing on corn, or they're sleeping, they're curled up, or that sort of thing, or they're playing with each other, wrestling around a little bit. And if we look to something like Walt Disney, one of the Walt Disney animators, Preston Blair, he actually published a book, and his book talks a lot about how to make things cute. And so he is a great guide for looking at ancient art and saying, well, does this meet his qualifications of cute? And one of the things that he says of cute is it should be rounded, it shouldn't have a whole lot of detail in it, and that's 100% the Colima dogs. Oftentimes these dogs are plump, they don't have a lot of detail. There are examples of Colima ceramics that do have a lot of detail, so it's not just like the ceramic artist didn't know any better or that they couldn't make things with a lot of detail. They were deliberately choosing to make things without a lot of detail. And finally, one of the things that he notes as a trait of cute is youth. And these dogs are proportioned oftentimes like puppies. They're not proportioned like adult dogs. So an adult Tlaltchichi, in images that we have of adult Tlaltchichis, they tend to be, if you proportion them the way that artists think of proportion, which is in terms of heads, how many heads long or how many heads tall a figure is, right? You might have seen that in comic book artists will often draw people who are like 7 heads tall. So
yep.
So if you take the head and go down, you'll see how tall they are. And that's how they keep proportion in figures. The dogs, the adult Tlaltchichi dogs, tended to be about 3 heads long. And these Colima statues tend to be about 2.25 heads long on average. So that is more the proportion that we would expect to see from, again, a puppy. So yes. We've got rounded figures, we've got lack of detail, we've got puppies. Altogether, this seems to imply cuteness rather than, you know, something that you should be afraid of or not meant to be associated with the same kind of rituals where you're piercing your tongue with a rope, right?
Right. With that, we're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be right back talking more about cuteness and dogs in Mesoamerica. So we're back with episode 27 of Ethnosinology, and I'm just going to let Zach just continue where you were at. This, I could, again, listen for hours.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, so I was talking a little bit about the cute, but I'm going to pivot now, and I'm going to talk about something that is less cute. Okay. I'm going to talk about the underworld. And so these Colima dogs are often found in burials. Unfortunately, a lot of them have been looted, so we find them without context pretty frequently. Mm-hmm. They show up in art auctions, and so we don't really know always what the context of them was. But we have found some in situ that are in burials, so we think a lot of them may have been related to burial practices. So, again, cute little puppy figurines in a grave. Why, right? What is the connection between these items and the grave? And what we think is probably happening is that these dogs are serving as guides to the underworld. One thing that I hear a lot is the term guardians of people who are traveling through the underworld. But when you look at these cute little figurines, I can't really see them, you know, standing up to a giant anthropomorphic skeleton that's attacking you, right?
So sure.
I don't really think that they were meant to be guardians so much as guides, right? And I think that they were more One of the reasons that they were cute was to be comforting in a time when everything around you is scary, in a time when everything around you is new. You're dealing with the fact that you have just recently lost your body. And so having something around you that is cute and familiar will help you stay calm, right? And that is true not just of the people who were being buried, but the people who were doing the burials, right? Because, of course, as we all know, funerals are oftentimes about as much about the people who are doing the burying as they are about the person being buried. So also having that cute iconography around would hopefully help take some of the edge off of the mourning phase, right? So Mesoamerican afterlife, again, Mesoamerica is a big place, lots of little variations in region, but it is different than what we think of traditionally. I think as Westerners who come from a Christian tradition, we think of the afterlife as you're judged by what you did in your life. The Mesoamerican afterlife was a little bit more, you're judged how you died. And so what's more important is sort of the death itself rather than how you lived your life. And so if you drown, you go to one heaven, and actually one of the best heavens was for folks who drowned. If you're an infant and you die, you go to a different heaven. You go to a tree that has milk coming out of it, and you're actually sort of recycled for rebirth. Right. And then there are different heavens, and, well, you know, heaven being not appropriate term culturally speaking, but there was a sky world and an underworld. And many times when you descended to the underworld, you would go through multiple tests in the underworld. And it was a very dangerous and scary place. Lots of skeletons, lots of decay. The lord of the underworld is often portrayed as a skeleton. So not a friendly place to be. That's why you might want to have a dog with you, because the dog would actually help you get through these challenges. And there's a real cool image in the Codex Laud, which is of a dog holding some sort of scroll. And the dog is giving the scroll to the lord of the underworld. And below him is a person that he has presumably escorted to the lord of the underworld. So the dogs weren't just, again, there. They weren't defending you from attack, necessarily. They had this sort of important role as, you know,
A character witness, exactly.
Yeah. And so that was something else that dogs were doing in that situation. And I forgot to mention this, and something I really like knowing is that in the Maya belief, there were four worlds. We're on the fourth world. The Aztecs believe we're on the fifth world. But either way, that means there were worlds before ours, and the gods destroyed those worlds for different reasons. And in the Maya belief specifically, there was a world where one of the things that the people were doing, among other things, but one of the things that people were doing was they were being very hostile to their dogs, and they were beating their dogs, right? And so the gods looked down at these people beating their dogs and were like, nope, you're all dying. How dare you beat your dog? We are destroying the entire planet and starting from scratch. And so clearly dogs were really important to the gods as well. And so the idea that a dog would come before the gods and present evidence of your good behavior kind of matches up with this other idea that at one point the gods literally destroyed the earth because people were not being super friendly to their dogs. And so we see that situation with the way you treat your dog will really impact the afterlife, because if you're a jerk to your dog, he might not give you such a great character reference when you get to that point in meeting the lord of the underworld.
Yeah, that was the wooden people, right? That was the wooden iteration of humans?
Yeah, I think it was the wooden people who were destroyed. And they actually, the dogs were allowed to, you know, go crazy on the wooden people.
Chew on them
and stuff like that, yeah. So maybe a primal memory when they're chewing on a stick is that time, right?
Sure. That image of the dog giving the scroll to, is it Mictlantecuhtli?
Yeah.
Is that Xolotl doing that, or is that just a different dog?
So that's a very interesting question, and kind of gets into the idea of how Mesoamerica conceptualized, you know, differences in things versus the form of something versus its actual. You know, what the dog was doing is taking the role of Xololt in that situation, but whether it actually was meant to be the god or not, I think it was probably just meant to be any dog, but the dog is filling the role of the god in that situation. And so you mentioned Xololt, I really didn't mention him too much, so Xololt is a god who took many different forms. Again, Xolo means monstrous, so he had maybe a more monstrous form, but he took a bunch of forms in his life, but one of the forms that he took was of a dog, or of a man with a dog head. And the story kind of behind him is that he was a twin of Quetzalcoatl, who is one of the chief gods, one of the lead gods. And when they were making this version of the world, Quetzalcoatl said that he needed the gods to be sacrificed in order to make a new world. And all the gods were like, to be honest, we understand that unlike humans, when we get sacrificed, we'll be reborn. So who really cares? You know, you can sacrifice me all you want. Except for Xololt, who was very afraid, and he ran away. And as he ran away, he turned into all kinds of different animals. So or plants even also. He turned into a type of maguey, I think, or agave. He also turned into the what we call axolotls today, right? Which is pronounced in Nahuatl. Xololt, so his name, right, Xololt, and then the axolotl, which is these little salamander guys that are super cute, their name actually means water dog. And so he took the form of one of them for a little bit. And, you know, eventually he was caught and he was killed and he was resurrected just as he should have expected to be. But for some reason, he was very afraid of that situation. But before he was caught and killed, he took a moment to cry about how sad he was about the fact that he was going to be killed. And he actually cried so much that in this almost like cartoonish sense, his eyeballs literally fell out of his head. So that's how much he cried. And after that point, he developed almost like a daredevil ability where he had this second type of vision that was different than our vision. And he could see in the dark. And he could also see spirits. And so dogs have that ability as well. They can see in the dark, and they can also see into the spirit world. So another reason that they're such good guardians or guides to the underworld. And so after that happened, there was a time where Quetzalcoatl himself, he descended into the underworld. And when he descended into the underworld, he was looking for the bones of previous people so that he could make humans as they are today. And he decided to bring along his brother, his twin brother, Xololt, who, although Xololt had this moment of fear, he still loved his brother and he still understood that his brother could help out on this journey. So together they went into the underworld, and the Lord of the Underworld got the bones for them and he said, "Here you go." And then as Quetzalcoatl was taking the bones out, Mictlantecuhtli turned out the lights and they fell into a great chasm together. And the bones scattered and went everywhere because Mictlantecuhtli was just tricking them. He didn't really want new people to be created. And in the bottom of the pit, it was completely dark. And of course, the only one who could see the bones to collect them again was Xololt. And so this initial, what had been a weakness, him crying and his eyeballs falling out, it suddenly became his strength, right? And that's how they escaped the underworld together. And then they brought the bones back to our world and created humans with them. And so how dogs became a psychopomp and how he specifically became that role as a guide to the underworld.
I talk about that in my lecture, but it was very vague, but that just gave me so much more context that I just completely was missing. So thank you.
Yeah, and you know, again, always to say, right, Mesoamerica is a complicated place with a lot of different belief systems. This is how it's written in one book, and you know, maybe the details are different in another book and that sort of thing, but that is generally how the story is understood to be.
Yeah. Anything else you wanted to get to, just feel free to just talk. I could listen all day.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so you know what I wanted to mention? I had mentioned earlier Teotihuacan and how there were wolves found there and that these dogs may have been serving as a sort of surrogate guide to the underworld. One thing that's kind of cool is if a warrior died away from home, as in they didn't die in their hometown, they would still need to go through these trials of the underworld, but they didn't have the community around them. So their burials often included a pectoral that was shaped like a dog, so that they would be going to the underworld with, again, this dog companion. So this shows up a lot where we see these dogs. We see dog bones, we see dog skeletons in graves. And in most cases, we think what is happening is that they represent those companions that were traveling to the underworld. I mentioned the Colima dogs. They're very cute objects. They tend to be drinking vessels, but there are a few of them that are actually, they're very strange in shape. And they barely look like dogs, but you can see by the snout that it is still supposed to be a dog. They're sort of like these, it almost looks like the things that people use to prop up their iPads or something like that. It's sort of like a triangular rest. And we find people interred with their heads lying back on these objects. And so we think the idea is that it was sort of like being buried on a sleeping puppy. And so I think that is a beautiful idea as well, right? So again, that way, when you wake in the underworld, you will have that dog with you to help you on your journey.
Fascinating. That is a beautiful would be the word. And it's just interesting to me how so many cultures around the world kind of share that same sentiment with dogs too, especially in regards to the afterlife. But yeah, it's fascinating. What's next for you? What's next on the research and all that?
So I have a ton of irons in the fire. One of the things that I've been really getting into lately is actually doesn't have too much to do with art. So I live in the city of Mérida, which is in Yucatan. Beautiful city, very well known for its historic colonial architecture. What a lot of people don't know, especially when folks visit here, they'll say, oh, I want to go visit some Maya ruins. I want to go to Chichen Itza, or I want to go to Tzibilchaltun. And those are beautiful sites, and I definitely recommend that if you're here in the area, you check them out, especially Tzibilchaltun. But there are actually tiny archaeological sites all over the city of Mérida. And there's a total of, I think, 200 and some recognized structures in the city that are prehistoric or pre-Columbian structures. And a lot of them are nothing more than just a base, but some of them are really beautiful. There are some big pyramids here. There are some, and they're usually off in tiny parks shoved kind of into the side of the city. And people don't know about them. Even the neighborhoods oftentimes don't know about them. So there's one near my house I can walk to. It's about 15 or 20 minutes from my house if you walk. And a friend of mine who is getting his doctorate, he did research in that area where he would go to the neighbors and he would say, you know, what's the nearest archaeological site to you? And they would say Chichen Itza. Meanwhile, they could literally look out their window and see an archaeological site. So, you know, there's just not a lot of knowledge of these sites. And that puts them in a lot of danger because they're being, you know, there's a lot of pollution and litter at some of these sites. There's sometimes the stones are literally ripped off to be used for housing. We think of looters stealing, you know, jade and gold, but in certain cases, the looters are literally stealing the stones so that they can use them to build houses nearby. And so that problem is really bad. I found there's an archaeological site in the far south that we're trying to do some restoration at. Well, not restoration, but we're trying to do some simple preservation work at it and get more attention to the site. And we went there a little bit ago, and when we arrived at 10 a.m., and there were two teenagers there smoking pot, which, you know, like, whatever, but, you know, do it not at an archaeological site, please.
Yeah.
And we went to the top of it, and in the last time, my friend has been documenting the site for 10 years, and this was his first time there in, like, 2 years. And between the times that he'd been there, it had been very badly graffitied, and someone had left a pornography magazine right on the top of the pyramid. So you climb to the top of this beautiful pyramid and you look down and there's porn. And
it was what a spot. Like,
you know? And so, you know, trying to preserve these sites has sort of, or get more attention to them at least, has really become a focus of mine lately, and trying to get with the city and try to figure out what needs to be done to protect them. And so kind of different from what I originally started studying, but obviously still really important because that it's very important for our understanding of Maya culture to understand how big these sites were, to understand who they had trade relationships with, and seeing them just in that terrible state with graffiti and literal pornography and people doing drugs at them is not my happiest moment as an archaeologist. So that's kind of what my focus has been lately.
Sure. I mean, that's important. Yeah, especially for those sites that are rapidly disappearing.
Yep.
Well, thank you for coming on, Zach. I really appreciate it. Where can people find you? And, you know, anything about the Maya studies or your personal information?
Yeah. So if you want to check out the Institute of Maya Studies, that's our website, is just our name, full name, instituteofmayastudies.org. And that's a nonprofit that's one of our goals is to connect people with academic research about the Maya in a way that is more accessible. So every month we publish a magazine called The Explorer, which you can get for free if you join the IMS. And The Explorer has a ton of articles in it, and some of them are a little bit more academic focused, but in general, they're trying to take ideas about new news about the Maya that you might have seen in, you know, on CNN or something like that, and say, well, here's what was actually happening with this story that had this fabulous headline about rewriting history, you know.
As all archaeology does.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one of the things that we do at the Institute of Maya Studies. If you want to, you can also find me on Instagram. My Instagram account is Archeogato, so kind of the opposite of dogs. It's a pun on archaeologist and cat, right? Gato in Spanish is cat. So my name is on Instagram is spelled Arkeogato.
Got you. All right. Followed by Luke Caverns. Nice.
Yeah,
cool.
Yeah. So Luke actually works over at the Maya Exploration Center. He does guide work there as well. So we're pretty familiar with each other. We're both very busy people, so we don't get to chat quite as much as we would like. But yeah, he's also involved in the Maya Exploration Center, so another great thing to check out.
No, he's big on that stuff. Yeah, well, again, I could talk to you forever if you ever want to come back on. I'm happy to have you.
Very much. I appreciate that.
Mesoamerica is something I know like tangentially about and just in the terms of dogs superficially. But yeah, to dive into that more would be awesome. So I'm more than happy to have you. And if you guys have any questions for Zach, feel free to put them in the comments or leave them on Spotify, rate and view the podcast, the whole thing. And yeah, thank you again.
Great. And thank you for having me.
Yeah, of course.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.